Well, we're going to take your phone calls, but first we'll talk with David Hatcher-Childress about structures on the moon when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. David, you've covered so many great topics. I don't know which ones to ask you about, but they're all fantastic. The structures on the moon. Tell me your involvement and how you even started looking at that.
Well, I did a book about 10 years ago called Extraterrestrial Archaeology, and there's a DVD that goes along with that, too. And I've always been interested in anomalous structures all over our own planet and underwater and giant megaliths in the jungle and all that kind of stuff. So it was natural that I should be interested in ones on, you know, off the planet as well. And as I began researching all that, there was back in the 70s, there was a couple of books called Somebody Else is on the Moon and Our Spaceship Moon. And they were talking about some of the early Apollo missions and also the Soviet missions, the Zond missions and stuff like that around the moon and the photos they had taken. And they were saying that, yeah, there were pyramids, there's domes on the moon, there's other structures, there's bottomless craters. There's a thing called the Blair cuspids on the moon. Those particularly interested me because they are basically obelisks on the moon. And a lot of the research that I had been doing as well into Nikola Tesla and his power system of building these towers and broadcasting power back in the 1920s, even.
Yeah.
Tesla had, a number of the books that we do about Tesla technology, which is all pretty fantastic. Tesla's whole idea, I mean, he electrified the world with AC power that we're all using today and everybody's home and your radio station and everything. But Tesla wanted to electrify the world with these towers. And as I looked into Atlantean technology, and I even did a book called Atlantis and the Power of the Gods, where apparently, like Tesla was using these towers, the ancients were using really what were obelisks, cut stone granite crystals, and they were cut in a certain way and tuned, and they were these giant monolithic towers. They're still there today in Egypt. It turns out that obelisks were around the world. There was an obelisk in Lake Ontario. There was an obelisk at Tiwanaku. The idea, too, that these obelisks were ultimately kind of power stations that were putting power out. Tesla had this idea that these airships would draw power from these towers. That's one idea, too, of the Vimanas and things, that they, too, were electric and they were drawing power from these power towers, and these towers were obelisks. And it turns out that some of these obelisks are on the moon, and they were called the Blair cuspids. And I get into those on the book. There's the Russians particularly were interested in the Blair cuspids. They are a series of obelisks in a certain pattern in this one part of the moon. And what we were mentioning before, and what you had said, George, about the Hindu epics and stuff like that,
yeah.
And that they, too, claim they've been to the moon, and it's possible that even these structures on the moon, like the obelisks, were somehow built by early Earth voyagers going to the moon, say, you know, thousands of years ago. How about that?
I love it. Let's take some calls. You ready? Monroe, Louisiana. Ricky, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Ricky.
Thank you.
Sure.
What I'm asking about is the mummies, the 8-foot tall mummies in Death Valley. Was there any DNA test done to determine if they were human or not?
Well, that's a good question. Look, a number of mummies have been found in California, Nevada. Some mummies, too, have been found in Arizona and Utah as well. Largely, they've disappeared. And even though we have photos and other stories of mummies, supposedly mummies were also in these catacombs in the Grand Canyon as well. But
what it sounds like to me, excuse me, but it sounds like it's kind of close to Bigfoot, which is at or about 8 foot tall, and we don't know, we've never had anyone to test, but it does sound close to, you know, a being that is that height could be my attention.
Well, that's interesting. Sure. And Bigfoot is tall, like you're saying. Yeah, 8 or 9 feet tall. My impression is that these mummies are not of Bigfoot or something, but actually of
humans.
Yeah, of
right?
humans, of humans who are wearing clothing, shields and helmets and all kinds of stuff. They're, in many cases, mummies are you know, wrapped up, or in South America, they would actually peel the skin off mummies and then put them back on. But part of the idea here, too, is of giants. And my next book, which is coming out in a couple of months, is called Yeti, Sasquatch, and Hairy Giants. And there's a couple of course, it is about Bigfoot and Yetis and stuff, but there are
and hairy giants.
About giants, okay, and just human giants. And if you read the Bible also talks about human giants, the Anakin. And that some of these guys have six fingers and six toes.
These are not the Nephilim, right?
Well, the
or could they be?
Well, some of them are the Nephilim, and they were other, or kind of related to the Nephilim, we could say. I mean, for instance, the famous story of David and Goliath.
Sure.
You know,
of course.
And he's a Philistine. But in that area of the Middle East, according to Genesis and stuff, yeah, there were still various tribes of people who were living, and they were giants. I mean, they were a normal person would say around 6 feet tall, but these guys were 8, 9 feet tall, even 10 feet tall. And Gog was one. That, I mean, there's many different stories of giants, and even giants of normally proportioned people. We have good photos of them, even, you know, down to modern times, in a sense. I mean, some people who are giants, like the famous Illinois giant.
Waldo? They had the...
They
buried him in a piano, didn't they?
Well, and he... Yeah. And he was not well proportioned in that, because some of these guys like him have some kind of hormone imbalance
or a thyroid
like
pituitary gland problem,
right? Stuff like that. And he had to wear braces on his legs and stuff. So I mean, he could not have really been some sports guy or basketball player. I mean, he could barely walk, in fact. But other giants are, you know, normally proportioned and are very healthy. I mean, they're big.
Robert Wadlow was his name,
right, from Alton, Illinois. But so some giants, you know, are athletic giant people. Now, one of the ideas that too is that wars throughout time have made mankind shorter. Mankind's favorite sport is really going to war and fighting, and just like in a football team, when you go to war, you put the big guys up front, and they get killed. So, in a sense, warfare has been making people shorter throughout history. The Napoleonic Wars, as an example, took the average height of a Frenchman down several inches, and the French are not known to be really tall people now, and that's largely because of the Napoleonic Wars. So, in a sense, people have been getting shorter throughout history rather than taller, is what we've been told. And in fact, like Cro-Magnon, man, he was taller than a normal man. He had a bigger brain capacity. I mean, so they, you know, our ancestors were literal giants compared to us.
Wadlow was almost 9 feet tall.
And there's, you know.
And he died at, he was 22 years old. That's it.
Yeah, interesting. So the idea that these, you know, these mummies are giants, I mean, people today, because of, you know, a better diet and stuff like that, people are starting to get taller again, say, for the last 100 years. The tallest nations in the world, actually, today are the Dutch and the Norwegians, too, very tall. And the tallest race of people, really, in the world right now is the Polynesians. And these are Samoans, Tongans, Tahitians, real pure-blood Polynesians. And if you go to Tonga or Samoa, and I've been there many times, you're standing around with guys who are, you know, typically 7 feet tall and big, giant guys, and that's just a normal person in those places. So if you really want to see giants, you know, go to Samoa or Tonga. You'll be in a whole country full of them, and they're small actually compared to how people were in, you know, ancient times. Apparently.
Okay. Next up, we go to Oregon, west of the Rockies. Go ahead, Bill.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call.
Of course.
And David, I've got about three questions for you. Have you ever heard of the gold mummies over in Egypt that Dr. Hawash wrote a book about?
You know, I'm vaguely familiar with that. Yeah, The Valley of the Gold Mummies, wasn't that book?
I don't remember the entire title, but they were anywhere from about 3 feet tall to over 8 feet tall, wrapped in gold.
That's interesting. Well, along those lines, what was really reported by the Phoenix Gazette in 1909 and what's allegedly in Death Valley, too, is very similar to the Valley of the Kings and the Valley of the Queens in southern Egypt near Luxor. Those things are exactly what they're talking about. They're in a desert canyon with cliffs, and then they are rock-cut vaults that go deep, deep underground with all kinds of passageways and rooms and things. So, I mean, what was reported in the Grand Canyon, I mean, that absolutely exists exactly like that in Egypt. And, yeah, there are mummies and artifacts and things like that. So in a way, what perhaps was in the Grand Canyon was the same kind of thing as this Valley of the Kings, Valley of the Queens, and that's where, like, King Tutankhamun was found, things like that.
Now, these were the Palladians that were here on Earth before any man, and from what I finally found out, they got diseased from diseases that came to Earth with the Nibirians, and after they died, they were wrapped in gold.
Well, that's pretty interesting. That would, if that was true, that would probably make those mummies very old, wouldn't you say?
Yes.
Like hundreds of thousands of years old.
Well, they're probably about 500,000 years old.
Okay, that's fascinating. You know, there's other stories similar to that of in Tibet and Mongolia, where caves of these mummies like that, and they're allegedly extraterrestrials, that kind of a thing. So, I mean, I'm familiar with those stories. I don't think that's what Zahi Hawass is claiming, though, about that these are Pleiadians.
No, not at all. Egyptians. Everything's Egyptians with him. David, these structures on the moon fascinates me. Possibly, could we have built them?
Well, right. I mean, the idea even that we, as humans, are extraterrestrials, that's another theory and one I find quite interesting. Yeah, the idea there of the obelisks and other structures on the moon, in one sense, is that, yeah, they are built by humans and by ancient civilizations. And, in fact, not only was our planet, ringed with a special grid, in a sense, you would say, of obelisks and power stations. They were like Nikola Tesla was trying to do, pumping power into the atmosphere. Airships, these Vimanas, could pick up power from these craft. And that these towers, which were stone, monolithic crystal towers, in a sense, pumping out power, so that the planet Earth had this power grid on it with these obelisks, and a similar system was on the moon as well. This goes even to Arthur C. Clarke's 2001, where that's their story too, where they find this monolith on the moon and it ultimately sends them to Jupiter. I recently read, I thought it was pretty bizarre, that Buzz Aldrin was claiming that there were these monoliths on Mars and on the moons of Mars, Phobos and Deimos, and that he had made some weird comment about them being some kind of obelisk or something there, and that that was one of the reasons we need to go back, or, you know, amp up the our NASA and go back to Mars so that we can investigate these towers on Mars. How about that? So,
okay, next up, first-time caller, Matt in Houston, Texas. Hi, Matt.
Hi. Well, there's a lot of things I would like to ask this man, but
he covers a lot, huh?
What I would like to know is, have you ever visited the Bosnian pyramids? And do you think they might be the key to opening the gates to a new line of thinking in the archaeological world?
You know, I know I met the main guy with those Bosnian pyramids at a megalithomania conference in Glastonbury a year ago. Semger is his name, something like that. I mean, it's one of those difficult Bosnian names.
Yeah, nobody really gets it right.
That's pretty interesting, that pyramid, and the Great Pyramid of Europe, they're calling it. A few of Zaliwas's friends have gone there and thought, yeah, this is a pyramid. Others have said, no, it's just a kind of weird natural mountain that looks like a pyramid. There's a lot of oddball stuff there, including weird stones. There are tunnels that go through that. I have not been there yet, but it is my plan to go there and check it out. And it's funny because it's one of those things where you read something about it, you see it, and you get really interested, and then the next time you think, oh, well, you know, it's not so interesting, but then you find out more, and then it becomes very interesting again. Yeah, there's something going on there, and that's a huge, huge, pyramid-shaped mountain. There's a lot of unanswered questions there, but it's not a pyramid like, say, the Great Pyramid in Egypt or the ones at Teotihuacan in Mexico or something, where it's clearly a totally man-made structure, say, like the Great Pyramid or Teotihuacan, actually made out of cut stone blocks, you know, and some architects and engineers have clearly designed this thing. That pyramid is, in Bosnia, is more like a pyramid-shaped mountain with all kinds of weird, weird stuff in it, including cut stones, but part of it's dirt. You know, the largest pyramid in the world, actually, is in China, and it's one of these earthen pyramids like the ones in Illinois, like the Kokia Mound, where it's packed earth. And they still are four-sided pyramids. I mean, they look like a normal pyramid, but they're not made with cut stone blocks. And the Bosnian pyramid is similar to that one, too. The ones in China are weird. And George, you've probably discussed on Coast to Coast a few times some of the Great White Pyramid in China and some of the other weird ideas of these pyramids in Tibet. Also, one supposedly has a giant crystal on the top of it. That's a strange story.
Great stuff. David, we're going to come up to the bottom of the hour here, then we'll come back and take final phone calls with you. Fascinating work. You really do. Travel. Do you go to conferences, say, anymore still?
Yes. Yes, I do. And I will be, just in a month, I'll be at the Ancient Mysteries Conference in Virginia Beach, Virginia, with the Edgar Cayce ARE group. I'm a speaker there. It's October 9th, I think. So I'll be at that conference. I'll also be at the Whole Life Expo and at the LAX
next year, I guess.
Hilton, yeah, in February. So I will be at that one with Eric Von Doniken and Zachariah Sitchin.
Super. Eric's going to be a show guest pretty soon here on the program.
He's a great guy, and I've met Eric a few times, and I've always enjoyed talking to him and getting ideas and listening to what he has to say.
Super. Well, stay with us, David. By the way, hey, beginning next week, I'm going to try something different on the program. You know, normally the guest will start in the second hour of the program, but you know what really plays havoc for folks on the East Coast who then don't get to hear the guest start until 2 a.m. So from here on in, the guest starting next week, in most cases, will start the first hour this time. And we'll either carry the guest for the full 4 hours or go the full 3 with them and then open lines at the end on the last hour, starting next Monday. On our next Coast to Coast program, Linda Moulton Howe joins us with her monthly series of special reports. And she's been all over the place. So that'll be our next Coast to Coast show. When we come back, we'll take final phone calls with David Hatchard Childress on Coast to Coast AM. David, are we doing a thorough job investigating the lost knowledge of the ancients, or are we letting this loose? There's your answer.
Yeah, right. Well, there's a lot to talk about, isn't there, George?
Yeah.
I will keep you busy for years, I think.
Let's go next to Old Orchard Beach in Maine, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Richard.
Hi, George.
Hi.
Greetings. I used to be a Navy cook, and
I think you cooked for me once.
I don't know. I was what they called a mess specialist.
Yeah.
Now they call them culinary specialists, which is a little nicer on
That's
the tongue,
right.
I guess. I ended up running longliners out of the Bering Sea, out of Dutch Harbor in the Aleutian Islands up there in Alaska, because I figured, you know, cooking was better than polishing torpedoes at the time. If you know about Dutch Harbor, it's riddled with pillboxes and anti-aircraft emplacements from World War II. And me and a crewmate of mine it was two of us. We were leaving Dutch Harbor, and Priest Walk was on the right, and to the left, you have these old, telegraph or telephone poles that are basically stripped. And there was this huge, speaking about Thunderbirds, there was this huge eagle. I mean, this thing dwarfed all the other eagles around it, and it was a bald eagle. And I was wondering if your guest, who went to high school in Missoula, Montana. I used to go to high school in Florence, Montana, which is just down the valley from Missoula. And I was wondering if he had heard anything from the Aleuts, the tribe, the natives there on the Aleutians, if they had ever heard of any great, huge... I mean, this thing was at least and conservatively 10 feet. I cannot believe it. I still to this day think I saw something that was just outrageous. If the other two guys wouldn't have been there, I would have thought something was wrong with my mind.
With you, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, right. A lot of the Thunderbird, Big Bird tales do come out of Alaska. And one of the famous stories, which was like 2001, was of the private plane flying there and them seeing this gigantic bird. It was flying, and there's been a number of reports like that. I mean, that's the amazing thing. I mean, it's, say, like Bigfoot. Bigfoot is, you know, he's in Ohio, he's in Illinois, he's in Tennessee, he's in Alaska, he's all over the place, and I'm a believer in Bigfoot. And, these giant birds are around, too. I mean, they're perched on trees, and people see them. And try and take photographs of them. I mean, there's more accounts than you would think, and probably many accounts, kind of like yours, that aren't told very often. And people don't just rush off to the newspaper to talk about their big bird sighting or something. Another curious thing that happened in the Aleutians too, and I talk about it in my book on Lost Cities of North and Central America. Was during World War II, they were building an airstrip on one of the Aleutian Islands, and they dug up this sort of ancient graveyard with all these giant skulls. And it's like a tidal wave or something had washed up all these bodies there, but these were human skulls. But they were like double the size of normal skulls. Ivan T. Sanderson wrote about it in one of his books, Things and More Things, where... a guy in the military had written to him about this. And similarly, like the story of the Egyptian city in the Grand Canyon where the Smithsonian gets involved and then everything disappears and there's, according to some people, a big cover-up happens. That's more or less what happened with these giant skulls that were found in the Aleutians and bones of what were these giants who appeared to be like twice the size of human beings. And we're humans, and that, yeah, these skulls also went to the Smithsonian and then were never seen of again. And it's kind of like the guy who's asking about DNA testing of some of these mummies and stuff, is that these things vanish. I mean, sometimes we have photographs, we have some reports, but the actual artifacts themselves are often gone. There are two museums in Nevada, one in Lovelock and one in Winnemucca, and they are both dedicated to artifacts that came out of the Lovelock Caves at the turn of the century. And what came out of those caves, too, were also a bunch of 8-foot, 9-foot mummies and giants, and they had red hair. And it's absolutely known that they took these mummies out of these caves, but where the mummies are themselves, no one knows. They disappeared. But two museums are in Nevada that are for the artifacts, and they talk about these mummies, and they do have some baskets and other artifacts, but the mummies themselves
have vanished, and so we can't do DNA testing of them. How about that?
You got it. Next up, let us go to, where are we going? Kansas City. That's where we're going on our wild card line. Hey, Russell.
Hey, George. Thanks for having me on.
Sure thing.
Pretty much I wanted to discuss that whenever I was in the Marine Corps, I was over in Okinawa, Japan, and I don't know if they were flying reptiles or what, but I seen two.
What did they look like?
That's the thing. It was night, and the first time I saw one, I was walking from my barracks. I was walking from my barracks over to the PX, and all of a sudden I just hear a thumping sound. And I look up, and I see this huge, look like a bat, flying above me. And then the second time I saw one, I was walking out of my barracks, and there was a barracks just right across the street, probably about 50 yards away, and there was one standing on top of it, and it took off, came right at me, and then it took off into the air.
What's your take, David? Creatures everywhere.
Yeah, you know, that's really interesting. And what I have found out and was saying earlier that the reports of these things are all over the world. And they are variously, and perhaps all three explanations and more, you know, would be part of it. But, yeah, you have your giant bat-type stories, and Ivan T. Sanderson himself in Cameroon back in the late 1930s when he was a young man, and he was also attacked as he was crossing a river by some giant thing, kind of like what your caller was just saying, and he had to dive into the river, but this huge, you know, winged monster, you know, flew at him, and he thought, too, it might have been a giant bat. I mean, we're talking a bat, you know, the size of a man, you know, but that would be three times as big as the largest bats, which is like flying foxes and things. So you have the giant bats, you have the giant birds, the teratorns or giant eagles and things like that. And then, of course, the third kind of the flying reptiles, which are supposedly extinct, the pterodons and things like that. And these were apparently the biggest of all of these things. But, yeah, even on remote islands like New Guinea, I was saying, the Ropans, in Africa, South America. I mean, and these things can be anywhere because, like birds, you know, they can fly over oceans and on currents, and there's no reason why these things couldn't show up, you know, nearly any place. So, you know, there's also the story of the Jersey Devil.
Great story.
Yeah, and that thing, too, of the Pine Barrens of New Jersey and stuff, it's a very famous story, and it too is like a pterodon or a chupacabra. It apparently was this dog-faced, sort of horse-faced flying reptile that, you know, was this demon. And when people see these things, they, you know, you're instantly frightened. They're very large. You're seeing them oftentimes in the evening, and you are afraid, and these things are scary.
Well, you know, I didn't ask you about the elephant stone of Aztec New Mexico.
Right. I get into that in the book, and that also goes along with the Buddhists and things like that coming to North America. And that was the elephant stones were found near Aztec New Mexico and also around the turn of the century. There were these slabs that were discovered, and on these slabs were clearly depicted elephants with tusks and things like that, with hieroglyphs and other strange inscriptions. I do reproduce those in the books. And that, too, is, you know, I mean, that's a very strange thing that there would have been elephants here, you know, in the Four Corners area in the desert southwest. But, yeah, that's something exactly that what Buddhists would have done was bring elephants across on, like you would bring horses and slings and stuff across the ocean, and then use them, actually came up, you know, to would be Farmington, New Mexico, and Aztec, that area right there. And that's the Zuni area, too, and of Chaco Canyon. There's a book written by an anthropologist from Oregon who claims that the Zuni language is a form of ancient Japanese. So there you go.
Okay, next up we go to Albany, New York. Michael, take it away. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I've just want to do two things. One is to thank you for your prayers, because although my vocal cord is not altogether back, but I am speaking without choking in every second word. I was half, I couldn't walk, I couldn't breathe, I couldn't eat, nothing liquid, nothing solid. I lost 30 pounds, and that was, like, in real trouble. That was back in February. And today, well, you hear me talking at least reasonably without choking. And the other thing I want to do is tell the gentleman that on a very busy rush hour time coming back from what we call the Crossgate area up here in Albany, other than Washington Avenue, and I saw 12 of these things that looked like pterodactyls, and they were flying low. They weren't flying very high. It was a beautiful day, and all the time that I saw them, they had this happy look on their faces. You know, they had a long, long beak, and a long beak on their head, and they're flying, and there was a lot of effort trying to get any particular place. They were just following the road, looking at everything that they passed. I thought, because the prehistoric movie Jurassic Park had only been a few months before, that maybe it was some sort of put on, you know, by the locals. But just realized afterwards that, unfortunately, I didn't have a camera, or these things were bigger than a car is long, you know.
Well, you got to have that camera. David, that brings up something, too. When people go out into different areas like you have, you got to bring something to document what you see, right?
Well, and people more and more have cameras and video cameras than ever before. So, we're entering an era where everyone with a phone, you know, is able to take a video. And the police, too, have all their dash cam recorders and all that. So, in my mind, we are going to have more and more accounts and, I think, credible photographs of these things. Last year, there was an interesting thing where these police in Texas with a dash can, you know, caught some weird animal running down the road, and they claimed it was a chupacabra. Although that chupacabra did not have wings or anything, and it was, you know, some kind of, looked like a sort of coyote with scurvy or something like that. But still, you know, it made the news, and the police were able to actually get a photograph of it. So we'll be seeing more and more of that. You know, and as far as these, you know, crypto critters that are out there, and even though they're witnessed a lot, you know, they're still elusive, and it's difficult to get pictures of them. You know, think of even mountain lions and cougars here in the United States. I mean, we know that there are mountain lions and cougars out there. They totally exist. There's no question about it. They even attack people every once in a while, and that gets in the news. But how many people have actually ever seen a mountain lion or a cougar walking down the trail or got a photograph of it? I was in Nepal 6 months ago at a game park, a remote one where tigers are known to be, and a tiger had even just some months before had eaten a villager who was waiting by a river and with his bicycle, and he was pounced on by a tiger and eaten. Yet I can tell you that if you go out looking for tigers, it's going to be a blue moon when you ever see one, because they are very, very elusive. But, you know, they exist. So so even these critters that, you know, we know are out there, they're hard to see, too. So, to me, it's a good explanation why there are not a lot of photographs of these things, but many, many encounters and stories about them.
Time for one or two more calls. Let's go to Pasadena, California. Hey, Roger, thanks for holding.
Hey, George, thanks for having me on the show.
Sure thing.
Great show, by the way. It's fantastic. And as I'm listening more, it sounds more like the show from last night with the phenomenon.
Imbrogno.
The negative magnetic, I guess, doorways.
Yes.
It's really interesting. Sorry, let me get to the point. David, this is fantastic information. I love this stuff. Have you ever heard of a book called The Third Eye? It's written
by Lobsang Rampa?
Yeah. I couldn't remember his name.
Lobsang Rampa. Right. He wrote a whole bunch of books, and The Third Eye, that was his first book. Yeah, 1955 or something like that.
Jeez, really? That's before my time.
He moved to Canada. I lived in Calgary in the end, that guy.
Interesting. Canada.
Yeah, he was a British guy, but he claimed that he was Tibetan walk-in, essentially. But that is a fascinating book, The Third Eye, and I've read a lot of his books. Yeah, that was a good one.
Last call, Portland, Oregon, we go. Go ahead, Dan, take it away.
Good evening, George. And first I'd like to say, before I ask David to leave us with the ending of the night, thank you for the show.
Sure thing.
I would like to thank the board op who answered my phone call, and yes, he put me on hold, but he answered my call in a very engaging way.
Good guy. Tom.
Anyway, David, could you just give us, as we end this session tonight, how you evolved from sensing the ley lines and going from there to evolving with the monoliths, and where you are right now? I mean, I'm having a sometimers moment, but I can go back into my library and I have at least three books that you wrote, and
All right. Well, that's good. You need to get another 20, though. Work on your collection. I'm hoping. Yeah, I mean, ley lines, energy is all around us, and there's an energy grid. The earth energies are flowing, especially in Great Britain with all the standing stones and Stonehenge and all that. I mean, ley lines, they were named after a guy named Ley, actually. And, this energy tracks and stuff like that. And even like the Marfa lights and vortex areas, Bermuda Triangle, all this, comes into these power spots and energy. Now, with the Tesla stuff...
It's about 25 seconds left, David.
We've got so you have the towers and the obelisks, and they actually needed power plants to pump energy into it. So they could work with natural energies as well, but they were also energized, like as we might do with a power plant.
David Hatcher Childress with his latest work, Lost Cities and Ancient Mysteries. David, thank you so much for being on Coast to Coast AM. Always. You do a great job. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.